Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 68, section 4, which is old single column, page 767. Okay, let's see. Probably don't need a lot of introduction here, other than, you know, they've been touching upon this issue of, you know, the social norms, you know, or the customs, if you will, and what basic elements were behind that that social institution being established. Like if you look back to the preceding section, remember we have that very powerful, you know, initial primitive influence of ghost fear. In other words, imaginings about some non-material aspect of reality, and all kinds of fear involved with the mystery of this imaginative domain. But, you know, it's the beginnings of primitive religious consciousness, simply because as soon as you start imagining something that's not matter, you are in truth, even though not in fact, but in truth, you're on the journey to an eventual discovery down the road somewhere that there's two substances. You know, there isn't just matter. There's another substance, spirit substance. And that just as science, genuine science, is engaged to the facts of the material substance, genuine religion is engaged to the facts of spirit substance. Yeah, so you know, you have that basic spark for something besides merely society, something besides what's predicated merely on the fifth adjutant, the energy urge of the fifth adjutant, the social urge. You know, you're beginning to get something that the sixth adjutant is going to do something with a little bit more, in a little bit more overt way, so that that society will begin to become a culture, and then you can begin to look for rudimentary, full human expression with a civilization. A primitive civilization, yes, of course, but something that is worthy of being differentiated from merely culture. And so when you're getting to, you know, that little bit greater level of sophistication, it's appropriate to have a term called more, which we'll explain here in a little bit, to describe that flavor of custom, group custom, relative to what's been going on before that. All right, so let's read a little bit here.
Evolution of the mores. All modern social institutions arise from the evolution of the primitive customs of your savage ancestors. The conventions of today are the modified and expanded customs of yesterday. What habit is to the individual, custom is to the group. And group customs develop into folkways or tribal traditions, mass conventions. From these early beginnings, all of the institutions of present-day human society take their humble origin.
Okay, so besides some of the precise details, there's something that should strike you right away as you step back from that paragraph and reflect on it. Notice the book ends. what they say at the beginning of the paragraph is what they repeat at the end of the paragraph there. So that's obviously something that they want to stress. So let's note that. See, all modern social institutions arise from the evolution of the primitive customs of your savage ancestors. And then, you know, basically repeating that at the end. You know, again, saying all, beginnings of all of the institutions of present-day human society. Okay, so if that hasn't sunk in, they want that to sink in as a foundational element. That, you might have thought, well, you know, there's probably some institutions that really didn't have any evolutionary predicate. They're just there because of, you know, the prince and his staff, say. Revelatory input into human society. It's, you notice, they made a point of saying all both times to stress that. Because again, like we stressed when we were just reading the papers about the prince and his staff, they're there as a revelatory influence, but all genuine revelation is evolutional. Right? It synchronizes with the evolutionary state of that time. It's fostering the evolutionary process. It's not in defiance of it. It's there, certainly shouldn't be in rebellion, to it. So everything, their ministry, they're waiting for something to evolve on its own, and then they'll foster that. It's, oh, that's an encouraging new element that's finally kind of distilled out of the mist in the evolutionary process. Let's foster that forward gently. And so that, when you know that it's all like that, so the truth threads that are flowing through all of these social institutions, see, they have their origin. That truth of eternity, that relationship to eternity, doesn't have its origin in some being coming down from paradise in some, maybe it's an indirect way, but some sort of descending ministry injecting eternity influence into time. It's innately there, right? Because you have two parents, right? It's not just the father that brings eternity influence into relationship with time. Your other parent, the mother, also does. And here they're pointing out it all originates in the mother. The father is just there to, the father-like ministry is just there to foster it, not to originate it. So when you think about, the father as a facet of deity, is one of the functionings of that deity is as an initiating influence, that should strike you. It's like, it was all initiated, by the mother, right? But of course, if you take it all the way back through the mother, there's an initiation in the father, but he's not doing it directly. His way is through the mother, right? Yeah, he is the will, but she's the way. It's an exception to the rule that there's any sort of a direct initiation, right? I mean, that's, what are the only two exceptions that we have any, basic relationship to? You getting a personality, right, it's coming directly from the father, and you getting a thought adjuster. But of course, even the mechanics of that delivery of that is through the mother. I mean, he can't do it all by himself, literally, right? The personal purposive nature is directly from the father and hasn't been delegated. That personal purposive aspect hasn't been delegated to the mother, and hence is coming directly from the mother. So that's an important thing to note. And it's there in the title, Evolution of the Mores. Right? To generalize your recognition of evolution. That's creativity and time. There's It has an innate relationship to eternity, to divinity, to perfection. It is not the embodiment directly of that, but those facts are coming into existence through that temporal process. The essence of that divine source is within it. Okay? And so we need to learn a respect for the products of evolution that that mankind currently doesn't have. We really are very dismissive of there being any value in the products of evolution, you know, especially for the last few decades, as we've been getting very intensely more spiritually animated and hence tending much more to self-righteousness and a dismissiveness of, oh, well, these old forms, these are just completely valueless. Let's just throw them all out and use our divine inspiration to, you know, make something totally new. Yeah. As if you know what's best more than the God of evolution, the God of the whole. Yeah.
Yeah, and what's going on today, it's fascinating to watch this hubbub over these athletes who are not wishing to stand for the national anthem. Mm-hmm. And there's no law stating you have to stand for the national anthem.
Mm-hmm.
It's custom.
Yes, it's custom. And how potent that is. Yes.
It's like people being high-minded about it. Oh, well, they have the right. They have the rights not to stand. No. There's nothing high-minded about it. It's just, I don't think society will settle down and be happy again until everyone stands.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it seems like an aside, but see, it's a simple example of just what they're going to stress. What I was just trying to stress. We have to learn that we don't have some right to ignore the products of evolution. There's a lot of growing belief that you do. You know, it used to be, you know, that someone would sooner die than even think that they had the right to vary from, you know, the traditions by even one iota. Right? I mean, it was just completely taboo to even think, you know, that, you know, you could somehow do some, you know, change that or do something in addition to that or whatever.
Jesus spent a lot of his life trying to get rid of the 640 traditions of Judaism.
Yeah, he did, but you know, he still was very respectful of what was going on. I mean, especially prior to his public ministry. See, again, and that's the difficulty with Jesus, you know, with his public ministry, because that's not just Jesus anymore, and so it's not so relevant to us. I mean, you know, him as God is doing things that you don't have a right to emulate. Right? You're not a creator being. It's like, well, you know, the creator of our local universe did it, so I have a right to do it too. No.
Well, he even did it when he was a kid and got scolded for it.
Yeah. Right. But of course, yeah, we all, but he quickly learned.
There's truth in what you're saying, but there's also truth in the evolution aspect of when things evolve into.
See, and again, there's a tension. Immediately I say what I said, there's a tension. You feel a tension. Yeah, I know, but it's just the tension we always feel. Our first thoughts, because we've been trained this way, is to make it a dichotomy. And we have to avoid that. See, I mean, just because I'm saying we should respect the products of evolution doesn't mean, well, I should turn off my creativity and not function as a person, you know, lest I do something original. You know, in defiance of the divinity of evolution. I'm not saying that. See? Right? But the key is, again, it gets back to that true and false liberty. Right? The liberty that you have a right to, your creativity, must be liberty in law. Right? And so think about the nature of evolution as being that law. Right? It's in that context that you have a right to be original. You don't have a right to change the context to suit your preconceived opinions, settled ideas, and longstanding prejudices, and then exercise your originality. Okay?
Well, Chris, where did the first guys get it then? It all stems from primitive customs. Where did they get there?
We'll get to that here. Just one second. Yeah, so that's kind of the next question that comes up. So the rest of that paragraph, they're bringing in this general term of customs, you know, contrasting it there to habit for the individual, custom for the group. Now, the term more, the word more, literally is just the Latin word for customs. Right? It is literally, directly, just the Latin word for customs, mores. Okay? But it's used in a differential way, in a specific way. Not just I want to be fancy and I don't want to say customs, I want to say mores because I like to say things in Latin. It's not that. Okay. And the other term in there, folkways. Okay, and this gets to your question, John, about how did it get started? So it starts out, right? Remember, your adjutant mind is attuned to your genetics. Okay, and so initially you have clans in terms of groups. You have clans and then you have tribes. Okay, and when you're in those group modes, it is very much just a genetically predicated phenomenon. Right? Those initial customs, those initial folkways. Folkways means it's just a way of the folk, right? And that folk is just a genetic phenomenon. So whatever the genetics is, mind is attuned to that. Mind functions in just a natural way relative to that genetics, you know, and certain customs manifest just naturally. That's how it gets started. So it gets started, you know, by, you know, in the why question of why is our genetics what it is? Right? Now, that's the origin of the initial folkways, the initial customs. But once you start to push beyond tribe to nation, one of the key elements in that transition is individuals are actually starting to think enough. Remember how they mentioned, you know, primitive man only thought when he was hungry? Okay. They're actually starting to think enough that they think about these customs. And they go, you know, when I think about it, if we set up a social rule like this, that would be for the general welfare. As soon as you start having those thoughts, see those reflective thoughts, stepping back from the customs, you know, the technically the folk ways, and considering them and thinking about how you even have designs to go beyond just a mere tribe, but to have this super tribal phenomenon. Okay, and he's like, well, I'm gonna have a much more polyglot phenomenon. And I need to generalize, and we ought to be a little bit more conscious about that. It can't be just this completely unconscious thing like it's always been that has produced these folkways, and, you know, through no conscious effort whatsoever. I'll mention that here shortly. I mean, they just come into existence, and no one's ever even thought about it. So when you start to make that transition to something that's more consciously assessed and considered in a generalizing mode, you know, just like, you know, promote the general welfare, right? Right, that expression. See, that's indicating that you're thinking about being a nation and not merely a tribe, right? And the general welfare. And you're now going to have mores instead of merely folkways. So it isn't just natural anymore. It's consciously determined and self-imposed, you know, in a more conscious way. I must obey this more, as opposed to just, you know, you're just going along, you never even thought about that, you know, you just do things in certain ways, and that's just the way you do them. Okay, so that's how it gets started. In that very natural way, genetic foundation way, as a folk way, but then becomes a more as you move to nation. And then obviously as you go from the mores of a nation to a territorial state, you go from mores to laws. Right? And you go from something that is, you know, within your mind that you impose upon yourself, that more system, to something that you abstract from individuals as a law. It's just out there abstractly. And then you have to be able to think abstractly enough to put yourself under those laws. In cooperative subordination to that abstraction.
Are those genetics then influenced by the spirit of the Agenes?
The adjutants.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I mean, but remember, it's the adjutants are attuned to the genetics. So the adjutants are kind of a blank slate, sort of just in the cosmos. They're brought into some specificity of attunement for a local system. Then they're brought into more specificity of attunement for a specific world in that local system. And then, you know, to a specific individual, you know, you. So they are turning the solidity of your genetics into a fluid phenomenon, right, that's animate. Can function in this adapting mode, right? Your genetics don't adapt, right? I mean, in the span of your life, right? I mean, there's no, you know, your genetics are staying the same, right? But you can adapt to the environment through the fluidity of mind, okay? But that, the initial framework for that mind, you know, if you want to speak scientifically, the mind has boundary conditions. Right, the framework in which that mind functions. There's internally, it's an energy, mind energy, so it has some laws of how it works. Okay, but then it's subject to these boundary conditions, these initial conditions, the genetics that it's attuned to, you know, and it functions within those constraints.
It's also influenced by spirit, right?
Yeah, once you're a human. Right, you know, there can be some unnaturalness to that mind, where spirit, you know, via a personality grip on it, can wield an influence on the mind, and the mind can do something unnatural, and that's what we were just saying, going from folkway to moray, so you can start to have something in the mind that isn't just bubbling up from the genetics, but is being imposed top down. Mind, you now have this new boundary condition that I've used my free will to impose upon you. You will function within these constraints, not just what are there naturally, perhaps even overruling what's there naturally. And technically the way that works, you can visualize in the hourglass analogy of your mind or self. You set up that more system in the upper domain. Okay, and it becomes the framework for the lower domain where all of the daily doings are going on. You know, the daily doings of how you interact with, or have an interplay with the environment is going on in the lower domain. But that is all predicated on those rules that you've established as if they were absolutes, right, in the upper domain. There's a seat there upon which you can place the more system. Wait, just 1 second here first.
So when you say law, what do you mean?
In this context, again, just, you know, that there are these boundaries. You must do what you're allowed to do within these boundaries. Stay between the lines, right? The lines are your friend. Like I said, I mean, technically, there's, in terms of how you actually use it, there's no difference between a more and a law, I mean, once the rubber meets the road, you know, you get some constraint that you're living within. But law, you know, in its literalness, is abstract from you. It's, you know, and that's, you're going from, when you go from nation to territorial state, you're going from the rule of men to the rule of law. And you have to have individuals that are sophisticated enough to comprehend the abstraction of law. Yeah.
So the adjutant mind spirits, mm-hmm. are spirit, and they work in the mind, and which is really, you know, seats on the brain, but really is not the brain. So in effect, their influence is a spirit influence on the mind.
No.
By virtue of the fact that they're spirits.
Correct? No, they're not. Because they're not. I mean, so they're not spirit ministries. So that's why it's very important.
But they are.
Okay, the adjutant mind-spirit.
Okay.
Okay, what does that term mean when they use that? You know, the full term is mind-spirit. Spirit is the foundation. Okay, but what it is in terms of its immediacy is mind energy. I mean, so think about how this works. You have a, I mean, in terms of the immediacy, you have a mind energy, not a spirit energy. You have a mind energy that functions in a certain way. You know, say it's the energy of loyalty. Say it's the third adjutant. That's just how it functions. It gives you this urge we call loyalty. But if that third adjutant is functioning in a human, you have a potential to follow that adjutant up to its base point. You know, basically its origin within the mother, okay? Because it's her mind that we're using. And she's not just a mind energy presence, she's also a spirit energy presence, co-present. So you don't have to, you know, journey light years or something to get to this spirit root. It's okay, it's right there and with you. But you can journey up in your mindal self to the foundation point of that adjutant in the cosmos, in the cosmic context in which you exist. And use your free will, use your personality to say, I'm going to take a hold of that root of this mind energy, that spirit energy root, and I'm going to add or modify what that foundational influence is on that adjutant's functioning. Okay.
Is that one of the reasons why you can sort of leave them behind? Or you can grow out of them, or there a need for them?
Well, I mean, eventually, okay, you're going to be using Marantia mind.
Or they say even first circlers can
get. Yeah, right. Okay.
Makes sense.
Okay, but again, use the hourglass analogy and the mindal self to appreciate this. The upper domain you want to think of it in difference to the lower domain, the kind of mind energy. In the upper domain, you call it spiritualized mind. It isn't literally, there's no literal spirit energy up there, but the mind energy up there is spiritualized. It's not spiritized, okay? It isn't literally like made spirit, but it's spiritualized. It's mind energy that where you have that immediacy of the foundation of that mind energy, that spirit energy that's above the hourglass, right, is influencing it, okay? And so that, you know, I mean, it's just so important to, you know, remember, you don't want to think of the adjutants as entities, as spirits, okay? They're not. They're just, I mean, they're not even individuated in any, you know, literal way. I mean, the first adjutant fills, you know, this entire room, all through my body, everything. So does the second. So, you know, right? I mean, they fill all of Nebadon, our particular adjutants. They're just a mind energy presence that has this localization attunement to you that follows you wherever your brain goes, right? You know, that mind energy over there will be attuned to me if I walk over there. Right now, the mind energy that's right here is attuned to me. You know, so you're just, like I said, if you think about the mind energy as a sheet, a rubber sheet, and you imagine pulling down, right? I could imagine that point where I pulled down that rubber sheet moving across the room. I don't have to move the sheet, right? The sheet stays present. I just move where it's pulled down as my brain moves through the room, because that agitated mind is seated upon the electrochemical mechanism of my brain. Okay. Yeah. But all these basic mechanics are important to sort out. Yeah.
I used to have the shot glass analogy of the mind, but got rid of that.
Okay. So back to folkways and mores. It's all about mind all selves. Yes. That's the background foundation. We're thinking about what's going on in these mindal selves, and how they are, what kind of social forms are in those minds that dictate how those minds engage their bodies and manifest overtly some sort of ritualistic movement or whatever. Okay, so it starts with folkways and then goes to mores when you start to take a little bit more conscious control of the situation. All right, let's keep going.
It must be borne in mind that the mores originated in an effort to adjust group living to the conditions of mass existence. The mores were man's first social institution, and all of these tribal reactions grew out of the effort to avoid pain and humiliation, while at the same time seeking to enjoy pleasure and power. The origin of folkways, like the origin of languages, is always unconscious and unintentional, and therefore always shrouded in mystery.
Okay, so let's start with that last sentence. Remember, that's what I was trying to point out, because it's not thought out. It just completely, just unwittingly, manifests, in that natural attunement to the genetics way. But think about it when you do start to become, it's like, wait a minute, we have these ways we do things, we folk. Where did these come from? It's shrouded in mystery. Oh, mystery, God. Oh, they must come from God. These are God's ways. Any violation of them would be taboo. Now that's how it gets started. That's why they stress that mystery. The moment that their origin, you recognize the origin is mysterious, the natural tendency is to come to only one conclusion. The mystery is God. And so, this is the difficulty, it always has been, of believing, even when it comes to mores and not merely folkways, believing that, your mores system are the laws of God, okay? It starts with the folkways seem to come, just come out of nowhere. And then even when you have the mores, when you start to reflect on your relationship to them, remember, initially, you have no clue that the upper domain in the hourglass analogy of your mind or self, you have no clue that's you. Right? The only thing that you think is you is the lower domain. But you've superconsciously implanted the mori system up there in the upper domain. And you're down in the lower domain where your ears are, and you hear this voice, inside of you coming down through this conduit, the neck of the hourglass analogy, a voice from above speaks to you, this is the way to do it, right? And you're certain this is God reminding you of the mores. Your conscience is God reminding you of his law, the mores system, and you better follow it. So that's the way humans have always thought. Humans have always thought that this the conscience is just the form in the upper domain coming down through the neck and being heard in the lower domain. That's your quote-unquote conscience, the voice of your conscience. Right? And we've always assumed that we top out, right, at the apparent pyramid point, right? We don't even see that there's a neck, that there's a conduit there. You know, from our lowly down on the second level of meaning, we look up there and it looks like it comes to a point, and that's our ceiling. And there's, you know, anything that comes down from another, not coming from within me, it's coming from outside of me. It's coming from God, or at least one of God's messengers or something. Right? That's the way we've always interpreted our, you know, what's going on in our consciousness. That's not the case. You know, like the Revelators try to point out, most likely, right? Right, this is not coming from outside, even though it appears that it is. Right? It's inside. That's you. And you know, even when a society has a mori system, you don't have any memory in general of, oh, that was the day that I adopted the established mori system, right, and gave it this exalted position in my mind. It just oozes into your pores from the moment you're born. Right? Just, you know, one day in your 20s, you know, you just find yourself conforming to this. And it didn't seem to, you know, ever have been adopted, you know, by you.
That sounds like the story of so many of the initiators or beginnings of so many religions. Oh, that's the process right there.
Yeah. I mean, initially when you were six and got your encirclement of the Holy Spirit, there were actually three cosmic voices put on those three seats in the upper domain, the three levels, the fourth, fifth, and sixth levels in the upper domain there. But over time, you know, unwittingly, you've taken what you've brought in with your associating mechanism, the lower domain, what you've brought in, and you haven't recognized that you've exalted certain things and begun to supplant who's seated up there. Not the objective cosmic reference that you were given by grace, but this stuff that you've absorbed in and exalted, because you're sovereign up there, remember. If you want to put something on a seat up there instead of the cosmos, no one can stop you. Universal Father can't do one thing to prevent you from putting anything, no matter how benighted, on those three exalted positions in your mind, those three reference positions, those three framework-forming positions in your mind. Yep.
So when you're really following the spirit of truth that shows you this is the way, you're actually doing it above the pinnacle point you're talking about. You're doing it at this level rather than at that level if you're doing it correctly.
Right. It starts out by, you know, getting to the point where you take delight in cultivating your reflective thinking, okay, and can get to the point where you have a conscious discrimination and you can get in the upper domain and go, wait a minute, I have a whole bunch of stuff up here that I've falsely exalted up there. Okay, let's clean house. Let's get rid of all that stuff. Let's try to get back to what was there by grace to begin with, which is of cosmic quality. I'm going to take delight in cultivating now using my three cosmic intuitions, those three insights, to bring more of the cosmos in on those three seats, to get more objective in that threefold way than what I had by grace at six. And then as I do that, as I begin to actually consciously augment what's going on up there, I can begin, now that there's the spirit of truth, I can begin to have a third insight that's about the wholeness of that threefold up there, how I encompass those three specific insights. That's when I'm using the spirit of truth. But, see, unlike with the three cosmic intuitions and the Holy Spirit, which you have a little bit of each of the three by grace. You have none of the Spirit of Truth by grace, none of that insight by grace. So until you start to use the three cosmic intuitions beyond their initial mode of grace, the Spirit of Truth ministry is twiddling its thumbs, okay? there's nothing for it to engage yet. You know, as they explain that in paper 34, Okay, when they give you those details about the difference between the Holy Spirit and the Spirit of Truth, it's like that. So obviously you see, you know, how that applies here is getting up there and going, wait a minute, that isn't my moral consciousness, like I've been calling it, because I don't literally have the cosmos seated in that moral seat. I have my more system seated there. I'm calling being moral being conformal to my more system. Okay? No, to be genuinely moral is to be in conformity with the cosmos, not with your more system. Okay? Subjectively, it feels the same. If you have a genuine moral consciousness up there on the fifth level of meaning, it speaks to you just like the more system that you used to have up there speaks to you. Subjectively, there's no difference. You just have to objectively have discriminated between them, because subjectively they sound exactly the same. I remember, like the Revelators say in the adjuster papers, remember the adjuster's up there too, and it's the same thing. If the adjuster actually manages to put a form in your mind, you know, that you could become conscious of, again, you can't subjectively differentiate it from any other detritus that you might have up there that's speaking to you. Right? That's why they tell you it's best to just, you know, to ignore it. Because it's most likely not the adjuster, no matter how much you want it to be. It's just something you've put up there and turned into this absolute voice in your mind.
It's leaking.
And the really potent ones that are up there, you have no memory of putting that up there. You have no idea that you put something up there. You're certain it's always was up there. It was put up there by God. That's what makes it so tricky. Scientific dictations, social usage, and religious dogma, right? That's what populates those three seats in general in our minds. Right? Especially since, you know, it used to be before the Enlightenment, before you really had science, you know, you had social usage as the mores system and religious dogma in those top two seats. But you still had the basic common sense of the first cosmic intuition there on the fourth level of meaning seat. Because you didn't have any science. But as soon as you started to have science, the dictations of science got exalted and supplanted common sense. That's why common sense is, you know, basically gone away, if not, actually, you know, ridiculed, you know. Yeah, as if something could just be up there that's worthy. No, the only thing that should be up there is what the scientists dictate you should put up there. Right, their settled science is what you should stick up there. Right.
Spoken like a true scientist.
Right. So, I mean, you know, see, that's why it wasn't until you began the 20th century, you know, you got post the three centuries of the Enlightenment. That's why this book is in my lap, because there's an emergency now. Because at least before that, there was at least something objective still up there. But now there's almost nothing left. We've replaced any objective cosmic, you know, framework with all of this stuff we've unwittingly falsely exalted in up there. So that's an emergency. If all three seats are now occupied by ignorance, exalted ignorance.
Who put that bilge pump in
right?
here?
Civilization is going to collapse, right? It has nothing to be, you know, to be predicated on that it will maintain, right, its integrity. That's the emergency. When you finally said, I'm not just going to have my mores system and my dogma up there, I'm going to have scientific dictations up there too, and now you've cut yourself off from the cosmos. And it can only go to self-righteousness. See, because there's no righteousness, there's no conformity with the cosmos up there anymore.
I have a nucleus, it's me.
That's the emergency. That's why the book is here, right? Because we actively are negating even the first cosmic intuition, rudimentary common sense stuff, that logical acumen, that basic logical acumen. Okay. All right. But we digress. Meanwhile, back to the text. Just you know, to notice that they are stressing what I was saying there, you know, and notice the pun at the beginning. It must be born in mind, as if it could be born anywhere else. Right? Especially like the Mori system, like I said, it's all in your mindal self. But you see, notice that about the effort. See, so there's some conscious thinking going on, right? The effort to adjust group living to the conditions of mass existence, the general welfare. Okay? You're moving into mores instead of merely folkways. And then again, that whole folkways, you know, the tribal stuff, you know, see how rudimentary it is, like you're saying, you know, what gives origin to those initial, you know, social rules? Well, the effort to avoid pain and humiliation, while at the same time seeking to enjoy pleasure and power.
Same as today.
Right, and see, the degree to which, like, well, nothing's changed. Yeah. All right, that's a, could be a problem. All right. Yeah, so, you know, that, you know, it's just like the, you know, one of the fun things, pairs like that is, living in constant expectation of getting something for nothing and constant fear of getting nothing for something. Right? You know, that's the kind of pair there, reciprocal, you know, influence they're talking about there. The pain-pleasure, you know, duality, for instance. You know, that whole bit about humiliation, you know, how potent the social influence is. You know, like especially, Eastern peoples, for instance, have a lot of you know, they give a lot of importance to that particular element in the construction of their mores system. You know, it's just, you know, the humiliation is just the worst thing, right? You know, there's nothing you can do but, you know, stab yourself in the chest with a long knife, right?
Keep
right.
Right around the corner.
So, yeah, I mean, you know, and of course, obviously, power. You know. So, just what mori system you have? You know, you set it up. You know, if you wonder, you know, why is it there's all these people that, you know, find a way to have so much power over others? It's like, well, the whole mori system is set up so that that works that way. That's our desire. So we've set up rules for how we conduct ourselves so that people who desire power can get it. It isn't because really they're so clever. We've designed it that way. Yeah.
Why is that in parallel to humiliation, though? It seems like it would be a different word.
Well, just think about the contrast, you know, whether you're full of yourself or feeling empty. You know, feel the power. You have no idea the power of the dark side. Right, I mean, all those sorts of things, right? And I mean, just, you know, whether or not you feel like you're filled with the energy or emptied of the energy.
Confusing it is a tendency to look at power as a negative.
Yeah.
And
right.
Power is not a negative. Power is just power.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, again, power, you know, what, you know, thinking the Revelation, you know, when they use power, that means purposed energy. If purposed energy is bad, then personality is bad. Because that's where purposing comes from. Right? Right? I mean, the only way to not have purposed energy is to not have personalities. We just all become fancy animals and cease to be human, then power will go away. That's probably not a good thing. It's like, no. I mean, there's supposed to be power. It's just you're supposed to wield power in the sphere of wisdom.
Well, that's not happening.
Right. Of course it's not.
So we're talking about corrupt
But again, remember, of course, that misuse of power, that's an indispensable part of the material comfort era.
But we, as citizens, shouldn't support that.
But no, but what you should do, remember, the reason that misuse of power exists, and it must be a value to it or it wouldn't exist, right? You know, God would have set up the system so that you could never misuse power if there's no value in it. Okay, the fact that there's a misuse of power means there's a value in that. What is it? It's the inevitabilities, right? It's the contrast, right? When you recognize, oh, that's a misuse of power. It's not that power is bad. No. The wrong is in is not on the power. It isn't mispower. It's misuse. It's wrongly used. So how would I rightly use power? An immature person say, well, we can prevent the misuse of power by eliminating power. I mean, that's the way simple-minded, spiritually conscious people think. That's the solution, you know, is to eliminate power. No, it's to go up, not down. Go up to wisdom so that you can use power wisely.
Raise consciousness.
Okay, yes. You know, the solution to our societal ills is not more rules and regulations. It's better citizens.
But one thing, Chris, about the rules and regulations, when you have this level of corruption that we have and no wisdom, I think you need the rules. It's like the Morris, you need them. And you need the regulations because we have... Otherwise, we won't have clean water. We already don't.
Sure, right, but just remember, you know, what you're doing. I mean, you're saying, okay, I mean, we're just too primitive. We got ahead of our skis, and this whole notion of going, you know, to a kind of country like we have, we need to back up. You know, we need to go back to the rule of men. You know, and a very totalitarian situation where everyone, you know, the problem with that is, you know, before that worked because of the power taboo. I mean, you didn't need a police force in ancient times because no one would even dream of violating even the tiniest rule, you know, lest the ghosts, you know, would, you know, tear you apart. Okay? So... you didn't need a police force. But now it's like, you know, you're not the boss of me, rules schmools, you know, I mean, I can do any damn thing I please, right? I mean, that's kind of, you know, we've got that, rebellion mentality in our heads. So it's a very tricky thing.
Yeah, it is.
See? I mean, we're in a transition time. Mm-hmm. Now, the challenge is to go forward, not backward.
Like
I said, I mean, you know, if you want the freedoms that this country is predicated on, it's predicated on the assumption that the individuals have internal integrity.
But we don't.
And if we're going to give up on that, then we have to recognize what you'll get. You can forget about your freedom, right? You'll go backwards. So, you know, that's in our hands. Do we find, you know, do we reach deep and challenge ourselves to have more mastered selves so that we can be more free? Or do we just surrender and become serfs to a system again? Yeah. It's an emergency. It's getting to the point where you won't even have the option. It's just going to collapse. And everything is going to go back to, a few... with some internal integrity, just completely ruling over the hopeless rest of us, you know, that can't muster any internal integrity to rule themselves. Okay, so, all right, so we're back here. Let's see. Anything else that we need to do there? No, let's keep going.
Ghost fear drove primitive men to envision the supernatural and thus securely laid the foundations for those powerful social influences of ethics and religion, which in turn preserved inviolate the mores and customs of society from generation to generation. The one thing which early established and crystallized the mores was the belief that the dead were jealous of the ways by which they had lived and died. Therefore, would they visit dire punishment upon those living mortals who dared to treat with careless disdain the rules of living which they had honored when in the flesh. All this is best illustrated by the present reverence of the yellow race for their ancestors. Later developing primitive religion greatly reinforced ghost fear in stabilizing the mores, but advancing civilization has increasingly liberated mankind from the bondage of fear and the slavery of superstition.
Right, so if you're not going to be ruled by this very ominous, all-powerful, imaginative force around you, right? It's got to be internal, like I was just saying. If you're not going to be ruled by fear and superstition, then you need to rule yourself. And you can't just say, well, we don't need to be ruled. Right, that's false liberty. Remember how I mentioned, you can see here, and they're bringing up the ghost fear and, as a predicate to religion, and, see about how that moving from mere society to culture, like I was saying, that's bringing in that more energetic influence of the sixth adjutant. And you see they even, give a little tip of the hat there, basically the sixth adjutant. All this is best illustrated by the present reverence of the yellow race for their ancestors. We call it ancestor worship. Remember, worship's a tall order. Technically, it's like they're saying there. It's ancestor reverence. It's just the sixth adjutant energy, augmenting this concept of the ancestors. Right? Like the Revelators say, you call a lot of things the worship of God, but it's actually the reverence of unity. I'm shifting, earlier, in the Revelation, they give you that contrast between the worship of God on the one hand and the reverence of unity on the other hand, and that, you get very sophisticated, have some spiritual consciousness, and so you have this very sophisticated reverence feeling. That feeling is about unity, not about God. At best, it's about God because God, you say God is spirit. But see, it's not technically about the personal part. It's just about the spirit part. And it's the reverence of that unity. And it appears to be the worship of God to you when you're reverencing unity, because it isn't just merely that abstraction of reverencing unity. You also have some sort of notion of God that you've brought in from outside. That you sit, next to your reverence of unity, and, as long as there's no gap between them, it appears to be the worship of God. But really, this is some primitive idea, notion of God. It isn't really God. And it's, the only sort of substance to it is the reverencing of unity in your mind. And then you're just kind of kidding yourself. That's why the book is saying, you really could use better ideas of God so that maybe you can actually get beyond some anthropomorphic primitive notion of God and try to get to the actual knowing of God instead of knowing about notions of God. Right? Because again, you get to actual God knowing this is on the sixth level of meaning. But you think, I don't have to go up there and add something up there. That seat is totally filled. Yeah, filled with what? Right, the dogma notions of God that you've brought in and lifted up and put there.
I pumped it up.
It appears that you know God. No, you know this dogma notion about God that you've exalted and put on that seat in your mind. And that can be kind of scary. If you think that the only reason you have a relationship to God is because of what you've thought or what you've done. No, you have a relationship to God by grace. there's nothing to fear, right? Just let go of this whole thing that, you know, you have to, you don't have to do anything, right? All you need is, like Jesus said, I mean, all you need, I mean, what Machiavelli to Melchizedek said 4,000 years ago, all you have to do is just take a hold of what was put there by grace. You don't have to do anything yourself. You certainly don't want to exalt some foolishness, ignorance up there and supplant God. So just, you know, let go of the fear.
It takes a long time to know God.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, what did Jesus say? You must enter the kingdom of heaven as a child, right? The child that all you had was the uncorrupted cosmos up there, right? You got to go back to that point. You can't find God in the midst of all that detritus that you've put up there, that you don't know that you've put up there. You know, and that every thought you have is predicated on. See, that's the tricky thing. Those are your initial assumptions. You don't have to have any consciousness of them. Everything you think and do is predicated on that framework. And you can't do anything but conclude what you assume.
Do I think the revelation helps you with that?
If you can, you know, well, get to this point where you recognize you have to replace something you have with something new. And not just see it as an affirmation. It's like, oh, here's a really cool book that talks about God. I know about God. Oh, it's affirmed my idea of God. No, it hasn't. Yes, it is affirmed that God exists, but your idea of God has not been affirmed. Just the existence of God has been affirmed.
I think for most people, yeah, the revelation has totally increased their idea of God.
Hopefully, it has, yeah.
Anybody in this room who didn't experience that?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think anybody thought of God the way the revelation talked.
We're all going
to
raise
our hands. It's too humiliating. You did. Yeah. Yeah. It's too humiliating to admit that we didn't.
Mm-hmm. No.
Well, you know, I'm going to have to stab myself.
But just, you know, just notice how, like you were saying, this is difficult to get this totally replaced. You easily fall back on old frameworks.
Yeah, but the truth is that my finding is you don't replace it like that.
No.
You know, you have to, it takes time. You work it through. It's kind of like...
Yeah. It's an evolutionary process.
Even in your own experience, it takes time.
The reason it takes time to replace what's up there is it took time to get it up there. And so it's going to take time to get it out of there.
Or to have it grow and change it.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and that's how it gets out there, remember? You don't actually go in up there and grab it and throw it out, right? You crowd it out by having the cosmos grow in there until there's no room for all that ignorance. It all gets shoved back down through the neck, down into the lower domain, and then you can, you know, exhaust it, okay? Through your tailpipes, okay?
What you were talking about, Jesus... crowded out. He never pointed at the faults or the errors. Never. He just always emphasized, he added something to what they had and he built on it. And it just crowded out.
But you have to give that growth permission, those favorable conditions, like humble. I humbly recognize that what I'm predicating my life on is not worthy. Okay, I'm going to let it be crowded out. I'm not going to take a hold of it with my absolute personality grip, you know, and dare anyone to change it. Don't you dare suggest that there's something inadequate about my social norm. Now, of course, the key is to not let someone else dictate your new social norm, right? It's just to let go and let God, the mother, God, the God of evolution, grow better norms in your mind. So you see the importance of that favorable condition of humble. Humbly let go of what's up there. All right. Oh, you know, it just occurred to me, and as I glanced up at the end of that previous paragraph, the whole bit about the origin of folkways and the origin of languages, you know, how they're both unconscious. Yes, I hope you see the difference, right? The folkways are coming bottom up and the language comes top down, right? You say one is a subconscious and the other is a superconscious input, right? But they're both unconscious. Anyway, back to this one. You see, they finally explained that whole bit about how potent the ghost fear is. You know, why it has such a huge role in social usage is because this whole notion that people had that they were very jealous of how they did it. You know, and if you didn't do it exactly like they did it, well, you know, there was hell to pay. And so people very, very, you know, soberly, stayed between the lines. Let's keep going here.
Prior to the liberating and liberalizing instruction of the Dalmatia teachers, ancient man was held a helpless victim of the ritual of the Mores. The primitive savage was hedged about by an endless ceremonial. Everything he did from the time of awakening in the morning to the moment he fell asleep in his cave at night had to be done just so, in accordance with the folkways of the tribe. He was a slave to the tyranny of usage. His life contained nothing free, spontaneous, or original. There was no natural progress toward a higher mental, moral, or social existence.
But nothing free, spontaneous, or original, i.e. nothing personal. Right? Just fancy animal.
For hundreds of thousands of years.
Right. That's your natural, right. Naturally, you're a fancy animal. Nothing natural about being a person, consciously. That's unnatural. Civilization's unnatural. Stressing that, this whole, you know, the helpless victim to the ritual, all the, you know, like I was pointing out earlier, and you go, okay, well, that's wonderful historical things. You know, think about, you know, that basic truth that flows through that. You know, we know that we're losing territorial state, we're even losing nation, you know, we're slipping back to where our ceiling is tribalism again instead of nationalism. And you should see how we're slipping back into these modes. You know, more and more you have this desire for a totalitarian imposition of this is precisely how you think about that issue. And if you try to think about it any way besides that way, right, there's going to be rage against you. See, that's that basic mode. See, like I said, that it's worse now though than it was in the past, because in the past you were this you're this automaton like this because of an internal imposition. The taboo internally was saying, do not do it one iota different. At least you were, you know, imposing that on yourself. Right now it's gotten turned inside out. Right? And we're moving into this very pre-primitive mode, right, of having the rage of others, you know, force this on us. That's the emergency again.
And what happened to love one another?
Yeah. What happened to tolerance, for instance? There is no place for any of those things when you go back where your ceiling is tribalism. Yeah, you can forget about any cosmic qualities like tolerance, altruism. I mean, right, all those things go out the window. Forgiveness. That again, it's an emergency. Obviously, you're not going to have a civilization if you don't have you don't even have tolerance, for instance. How you can have a civilization? Right? I mean, you don't need tolerance when everyone is basically genetically the same, especially like in a clan where they, you know, very much are all genetically the same, or relatively so in a tribe. I mean, everyone is just kind of naturally on the same page. Right? It's those people in the other tribe that aren't on the same page naturally, you know, that you kill whenever you see, and, you know, there's no tolerance for difference. But if you're going to have a nation or, you know, or greater, if there's no tolerance, it doesn't work. Right? You have to be tolerant of someone who isn't naturally, doesn't have the adjutants naturally attuned to them like they're attuned to you. And you have to stop thinking, well, the God says that my attunement is right, and so any other attunement must die. Like I said, I mean, that's what appears, right? It appears that, right? It's the voice of God coming down inside of you saying, this is the way that is right and only this way. I mean, this is, again, all of this stuff is, it's interesting historically, but it's relevant today, is the truth, right? Why is there emergency? Because we're seeing ourselves slipping into these very primitive estates, or worse. I mean, these people just couldn't see. There's none so blind as those who will not see. See? We're actually personal and willfully blinding ourselves now, unlike these very primitive peoples. That's much worse. All right. Let's keep going.
Early man was mightily gripped by custom. The savage was a veritable slave to usage. But there have arisen ever and anon those variations from type who have dared to inaugurate new ways of thinking and improved methods of living. Nevertheless, the inertia of primitive man constitutes the biologic safety brake against precipitation too suddenly into the ruinous maladjustment of a too rapidly advancing civilization.
Now they brought it, right? You know, like you hear me bring that up all the time. There's where the rubber meets the road of the emergency. The current so-called conventional wisdom, right, that there is no such thing as too rapid advancement. Progress is innately divine, you know, if you will, right? So much so that you can make it an ism. Look at that ruinous maladjustment, right? The mal prefix means bad. If you go too fast, your tentative relationship to unity is broken. You get ahead of your skis. You know, like if you want to use that an example. We have such a tentative relationship to unity as individuals. You can easily outrun that tentative relationship, and so then you lose the associativity. The whole social structure breaks down because it doesn't magically come into existence. Associativity is only there if there's individuality and unity, and the super additive consequence is associativity. Right? And so the more immaturely spiritually conscious you get, and the more impatient you get, you know, what do we want? Fill in the blank, when do we want it now? Right. That's what they're talking about. Right? We're breaking, you know, in the name of unity, we're breaking our relationship to unity. And it's gonna collapse the whole associativity.
But I think very few people really realize that, do you?
Of course. I mean, if there was anyone that recognized it, they couldn't tell us right here. I mean, this book wouldn't be in our lap. You know, at the very least, you know, they would have just sent a postcard that said, "See Bob's writings." Right? Because he's figured it out. No, there is no such writing. This is a revelation. It's an affirmation of none. That's what a revelation is. We don't get this. There's a physics to this. You must pull back on the reins of that spirit energy in your mind. You can't just let it run free, because you quickly outrun your initial child of God relationship to the cosmos.
And Is that what wisdom helps do?
Yes. Wisdom, you know, is a governor, okay. You know, for instance.
And as you said before, that's why we're quivering on the ground.
We need change, yes, but we need prudent change.
We need prudence.
We need prudent everything. We need wise everything. Right. Yeah, there's no wisdom. Hence, there's no civilization possible. Right, because, you know, like we pointed out, I mean, you have basic society and predicated on the fifth adjunct. You augment it with culture with the sixth. How do you get civilization? With the seventh, the spirit of wisdom and the Holy Spirit that connects you to, you know, insight. You know, wisdom, insight, foresight give you civilization.
In my life, you know, when I was younger, I was a lot more impatient, but life hit me over the head a number of times and taught me that, you know, being impatient didn't really work. And so you get a little bit of wisdom as you get older, maybe not as you're younger. My kids were, you know, they got all the wisdom in the world, but they really don't in terms of, you know, being able to know a lot of stuff. But I think it comes more, you know, wisdom doesn't seem to come when you're young or right away.
Of course not.
Just as an adjunct that being activated, it still takes time, doesn't it?
Yes, of course. It's a temporal phenomenon. It comes from the temporal God, God the Mother. It's her wisdom. Again, you know, remember, you can't get wisdom except through tribulation. Right? It's a vast conspiracy the way it's set up, because your first thought is not that there's something problematic about impatience. You're pretty certain initially that there's nothing problematic about that. I mean, you know, I mean, things need to be changed, and they need to be changed right now. So instead of questioning your impatience when you fall on your face the first time, you know, I know what the problem was. I wasn't zealously impatient enough. If I'm just more zealously impatient next time, I'll succeed. Right? And so you turn the volume up from 1 to 2, fall on your face again. You're still certain there's nothing fundamentally problematic about impatience. So you try volume 3 and then 4. Right?
Damn it, there should be.
Back to this. So the so notice the contrast in that paragraph. He's mightily gripped by custom. But they point out, but every once in a while there's an exceptional individual, and that's wonderful. But they know where you are. I shouldn't just say, you know, our immature spiritual consciousness goes next with that. It goes, we need to, you know, give those individuals more and more, you know, liberty of expression, and we need to eliminate all of this inertia breaking, and then we'll go forward. No, again, I mean, there's the grace of inertia, because technically we can't go very far yet. At best we can take one step. We all want to take 20 steps. We have to submit ourselves to the divine grace of that inertia. You're material for a reason. You're not self-animating for a reason. So you don't go too fast. We don't have the wisdom to be, you know, very spiritual yet, because you have to be able to steer at very high speed, right? I mean, when you teach a kid how to drive, you know, you don't start him at 120 miles an hour. You know, we all know that's not going to end well. right?
Well, I was really lucky.
Yeah. So. Like I said, that's what the main thing they're challenging. They know where we are. They know we're more spiritual now than humans have ever been. They know we have this tension, this drive, this energy that wants to go fast. But we have to, you know, be patient and humble. Those favorable conditions. We will go forward. We need to be grown forward. Man cannot cause growth. Change without growth is potential evil. Yeah, like they said there, maladjustment. You're not going to get the goodness that you envision with this untempered progressivist mind. Right? You're going to get evil. You're going to get that breakage from the unity. Right? That's the evil. Breaking your relationship with the unity, and all the associativity will evaporate. The whole, you know, your whole visions of the brotherhood of man will disappear in the blink of an eye. Another thing I thought of, and I didn't mention it up there. Did you notice in that third paragraph when they said preserved inviolate the mores and customs? There you can see, obviously, they're not synonyms. Even though technically is a Latin word, they are. But they're using custom as sort of the foundational word, and mores is built upon that mere custom foundation. Again, just reminding you of how you're not going to get what you envision naturally. You know, it requires wise, conscious choice to produce a genuinely progressing phenomenon. If you do anything else, you'll get retrogression, not progression. Okay.
But these customs are not an unmitigated evil. Their evolution should continue. It is nearly fatal to the continuance of civilization to undertake their wholesale modification by radical revolution. Custom has been the thread of continuity which has held civilization together. The path of human history is strewn with the remnants of discarded customs and obsolete social practices, but no civilization has endured which abandoned its mores, except for the adoption of better and more fit customs.
Yeah, I've already basically explained that. You know that's what's been happening for well over 100 years now, to an unfortunate degree, is that recognition. You know, you have more spiritual consciousness, so you can project farther forward idealistically, and so you see the inadequacies of the current mores system all the more. You want it to change all the more, but you don't want it to evolve. Remember, initially your spiritual consciousness doesn't see goodness. It's just an error and evil detector. And it appears, that's all it does. That's why I said, but these customs are not an unmitigated evil, right? To merely a child of God, that's what customs will appear. As soon as you get any sort of initial spiritual consciousness, that's what the customs will look like to you, an unmitigated evil, right? You'll advocate for their complete rejection, just toss it all out. No recognition that there's a baby in that bathwater, right? To use the overused expression, but it works so well. And it's not like we saw up front, there's a thread of truth. No matter how primitive the mores system, there's a thread of truth flowing through it because it's an evolutionary product. Right? And you have, even if you can't see that, you have to know that. You have to respect that. You have to very humbly go about chucking apparently babyless water. Okay? You want to be very slow about, saying, oh, there's nothing here. Let's just toss that out. And the whole bit of it, you know, wholesale modification by radical revolution. You know, we all know as soon as we got more spiritually animated, the word revolution, you know, started to be on everyone's lips. Now, so let's take one little aside on that, though, because it's important. It's not that the word revolution is entirely bad. It's just it's entirely bad the only way humans have ever thought about it. Because all of humans have ever really recognized at best is mind and matter. And thinking about that interface of mind over matter. And so when the word revolution pops in their head, that's the only place they have to apply that revolution, is using mind to turn around matter. You know, remember the word revolution, you know, like the sun revolving around, or the earth revolving around the sun. Not Ptolemaic, where the sun is revolving around the earth, but you know, the earth revolving around the sun, right? I mean, it's the same word. I mean, it means, you know, you're turning it around. And that's the only place we've ever thought of that word could be applied. Mind over matter, mind turns matter around. You know, it's an outer life. It's an external world thing. No. All right. There's a direction in to your outer life, to the external world, dictated by evolution, and that direction is good. Okay, and it shouldn't be turned around by your self-righteous hand. Okay. It's like, well, then why did someone put the word into my head? You know, that language that comes down from above. What am I supposed to do with this word, revolution? There's another interface. Right? Spirit over mind. Right? It's entirely appropriate for you, above your mindful self, to take a hold of that and turn it around. Right? You're sovereign there. And like we've seen so many times, how many times when you recognize the revelators are saying about something, you go, wait a minute, we're exactly 180 degrees different than that. Yeah, see? It needs to be turned around.
That's why you say
be Yeah. So, and that's why, you know, see, the French Revolution and the Russian Revolution, okay, so that's outer life stuff, and and the fact that it's rebellion is obvious. Right? But if you're going to say American Revolution, you've got to make sure that you know, the genuineness of using that expression, American Revolution, is that it was spirit over mind. It was inside that things were turned around. And the Founding Fathers knew that. Those who try to get us to forget the Founding Fathers, you know, have gotten us to forget that and focus just on the external world. That's what they did. They turned things around inside, as they should. As they have the right to do, because you are sovereign there. When you recognize that you're turned 180 degrees to the cosmos, turn it around. Impose a revolution in your mind. But don't think that you have the right to project that outwards, right? Making personal plans for others. Okay, so that the word revolution is a very dangerous word when you don't know anything about a genuine inner life. Custom has been the thread of continuity which has held civilization together. Right? I use the thread analogy all the time, right? For what? The thread of truth. Yes. All right. Like I said, there's a truth thread. Recognize that. Don't throw out the truth thread. That's the baby. Right? Bathwater is all the temporal stuff that's wrapped around it. Let's see. Yeah, and just, you know, that, you know, think about the whole about, you know, except for the adoption of better and more fit customs. You know, think about it a little less with customs and more with what, you know, we think of as religion. you get a little bit more enlightened and you recognize, wow, these religious dogmas are really primitive and silly. That's a race religion. We're finally free from all that foolish fear and superstition. No. You need to replace it by something better and more fit. Take the religions up. Don't throw them out. So we have all, we now we have almost no moray system left. I mean, that's why there's family is all falling apart and everything is all falling apart. Because we thought, well, the customs of families have always been really primitive and bad, so let's just get rid of families.
Chris?
Yep.
One thing I noticed about Facebook, though, one of the things I like about it is that you do see the customs of families, and it's a lot like that. I mean, it's a lot of people who are really trying to hold on to their family life and have their customs and mores, and I like that.
Yeah. And we have to be very tolerant and patient on this planet because we have a broad spectrum of individuals. I mean, you have to allow people to be where they are in the evolution of the mores. The moment you think you have a right to impose some supposedly more enlightened mores system on them, you're in rebellion to the cosmos. Everyone has a right to be where they are in the evolutionary process. We just have to be wise enough to manage people in all different states of the evolution of the mores. That's the tricky part. Okay. Civilization is in jeopardy because there isn't such wisdom. Right? We can't even manage people that are all in the same mores system, let alone people that are in different mores systems. Okay, keep going.
The survival of a society depends chiefly on the progressive evolution of its mores. The process of custom evolution grows out of the desire for experimentation. New ideas are put forward. Competition ensues. A progressing civilization embraces the progressive ideas and endures. Time and circumstance finally select the fitter group for survival. But this does not mean that each separate and isolated change in the composition of human society has been for the better. No, indeed no. For there have been many, many retrogressions in the long forward struggle of Urantia civilization.
No, indeed no. See, when I pound the table on those things, right, that's not me, right? That's the revelators pounding the table on that issue. Change without growth is potential evil. It's very dangerous terrain, as they're trying to stress there. The fact that so often we go, wait a minute, we're 180 degrees off on that. Right. It's because what we think is a progression is actually a retrogression. We're so ignorant, backward looks forward to us.
I'm surprised they didn't put quotes on forward.
All right. Now, of course, you've got a number of very controversial things in there between the lines, as I reminded you up front in this. I mean, there is the ruggedness of an evolutionary process, not just to biology, but to social evolution as well. You've got that foundational survival of the fittest thing, when you consider, doesn't feel warm and fuzzy. Think about how many supposedly enlightened people today consider competition to be innately evil. Well, look what they just said there. The process of custom evolution grows out of the desire for experimentation. New ideas are put forward. Competition ensues. it's an indispensable part of the process, competition. You have to allow competition. Yes, it's rugged, but it's necessary. So you have to, you know, you have to have a bigger picture in mind. You can't just judge it by the immediacy in the moment of time of the value of competition. And that whole bit of experimentation. How is that embodied in the foundation of this country? In a very, you know, fundamental, basic way, we've institutionalized experimentation. Do we have one state?
Oh, 50 states.
Or many states, yes. Right? That's the whole point. Laboratories.
Keep your dishes.
Right, of experiment. Right? You have multiple states, right? So that state can try that experiment, that state can try that experiment. You know, and over time, competition between the states, we discover, oh, this is the better way to do it. Right? But you just make that discovery upon the backs of those who failed. It's like, oh, that's so harsh. We don't want anyone to ever have to suffer a failure. Let's just have this self-righteous, divine understanding of things, and let's forget about states being different. Let's just impose a common thing on all states from the supposed top-down wisdom, objective, and perspective. You know, notice how we're getting into that mode more and more. We don't allow states to have differentials.
Just a quick example of that. Cars that operate without a driver is a brand new phenomenon.
Yep.
Okay. Instead of letting the different states take this new issue and figure out ways to deal with it, some better than others, some poor, the federal government has found time amidst all of their important things to do.
Yes.
And trying to impress upon all the states rules
yes.
to deal with this new phenomenon.
See, again, it's this complete rejection of the evolutionary process.
Yes.
You're trying to do everything by fiat.
They don't make a self-driving car.
It's like, no. I mean, pain and suffering are essential to progressive evolution. The only way to have a society where no one ever suffers an injustice, quote unquote, right, is to be absolute slaves. I mean, to have no freedom at all. And so we have to allow for pain and suffering. We now think that someone needs to be just, you know, totally ridiculed and, you know, eliminated from, you know, any avenue of power if something bad happens to someone under, you know, their guidance. I mean, we're just really absurd about this now. It's like, no, we know we need wisdom. The only way to get wisdom is through tribulation. If you eliminate all tribulation, there will never be any wisdom. If no one ever has tribulation relative to greed, there'll never be any wisdom developed relative to greed. And we'll be in an eternal, changeless state of greed.
But trying to eliminate greed just creates more tribulation.
Right. I mean, yeah. I mean, there's a few people that recognize that the moment you try to eliminate tribulation, you don't get less tribulation, you get more tribulation. Right? Because you can't change without growth as potential evil. It has to grow into less tribulation. You can't just build something with less tribulation.
Design it out
of existence. I mean, again, if there wasn't value in tribulation, it wouldn't exist. It's there for a reason. Recognize that, respect that. You know, and again, you know, this is, remember, not for those timid souls. Right? That's what's going on here. We're talking about the rugged truths of the Revelation. It's a rugged truth that you have to allow the rigors of the evolutionary process to play out, because that's the only way things will. That's the only way you'll get that positive progress that you envision. I mean, you can't make it by fiat.
In the life of Jesus, how he let that play out, and
yeah,
it looked like the worst tribulation. Would they say it looked like the end of the world? But
Friday, but then the resurrection day was a different story. Yeah. So that's a decent example.
Yeah, anyway. You got it. And we have to trust the evolutionary process. Doesn't mean that we shut down, like I said up front. But you learn how to help it, not how to replace it, not thinking that you're put here to replace it. You're put here to help it, humbly help it. Find its value and foster that. Jesus came upon someone, they're evolving from child to an adult. He didn't try to eliminate all of their imperfections. He tried to find the thread of truth and foster that forward. It's the same thing we have to do with society in general, all of our institutions. There's a value in every institution that exists. It's the challenge is, can you see it? And if you can't, get more insight. Yeah, some of them are going to be very difficult. You know, we talked about that before. We're coming up on it. You know, war, right? What is it good for? Let's see. Where are we here? Let's see here. Is there anything else that we needed to bring out there? I think we got everything there. Let's see how far we can get here in the next section. This was fairly straightforward.
Land techniques, maintenance arts. Land is the stage of society. Men are the actors. And man must ever adjust his performances to conform to the land situation. The evolution of the mores is always dependent on the land-man ratio. This is true, notwithstanding the difficulty of its discernment. Man's land technique or maintenance arts plus his standards of living equal the sum total of the folkways, the mores. And the sum of man's adjustment to the life demands equals his cultural civilization.
See, so they're giving you some of the science of it there. We don't have to unpack all of the science there. But, you know, don't make, simple stumbles. You know, when they say the folkways, comma, the mores, it should be apparent now that those aren't synonyms, right? So that isn't, that parenthetical doesn't have an equal sign between, you know, that comma can't be replaced by an equal sign. They're just saying the sum total of the folkways, or if you have mores, the mores, right? Land-man ratio, what's that ratio? Given amount of land, increase the number of people on that land, the land-to-man ratio goes down, right? The denominator's increasing, so the ratio's decreasing. That ratio, thinking about that ratio. The other thing there is, this is true, notwithstanding the difficulty of its discernment. We were just talking about that. I mean, that's the authoritative elimination of error, the revelation of truth. They're telling you things that are either very difficult to see or not apparent at all. That's the point. It's going to disagree with what, you know, appears to you, how things appear to you.
So it's always dependent on the ratio. Does that mean a lower ratio is better than a higher ratio, or doesn't say that?
It's all relative to the circumstances and stuff, you know. And in a more complex society, you know, the land-man ratio is a function of location and stuff, right? I mean, and institution and whatnot. It's a very complex thing. But they're just trying to give you a little sense of that, to think about that ratio. One of the reasons that it's true that those two are together, inseparably together, okay, with land, you know, you think about just matter, and you have energy pattern, or what we just call pattern. Man, personalities, or spirit pattern, they appear to be very separate. On the one hand, there's energy pattern. On the other hand, there's spirit pattern. On the one hand, there's, you know, there's power. And on the other hand, there's personality, say. But if you follow it back to the source of the pattern, the first source and center, there's only one pattern. Right? There's no difference between the two at the source. So that should tell you that they're inescapably coupled out there, right, in the trenches of their application, right? Like on Havona, right? The world and the people are all one system. You know, it's not a people system on an independently different world system, right?
Hard to imagine.
Right? Yes. That's fundamentally why that's true. You know, and it's why we're called humans. Up from the humus, too. The truth of that. Right? You have a link to the land. Everything you do is linked to the land because you're up from the land. You're up from the humus as a human.
And the super additive effect is the standard of living.
Yeah, getting into that, right? You put the two together. Yeah. All right, let's see what they say here about some of these details.
The earliest human cultures arose along the rivers of the Eastern Hemisphere, and there were four great steps in the forward march of civilization. They were...
Okay, before you read, just, you know, one little thing. See, rivers, it's just reminding you, if you want to think about people in the past, it all revolved around rivers. Right? If you don't already know that, you know, anthropologically, you should. You know, so the mores of basically all ancient peoples were predicated on relationship to rivers. Yeah. Okay.
One, the collection stage, food, coercion, hunger, led to the first form of industrial organization, the primitive food gathering lines. Sometimes such a line of hunger march would be 10 miles long as it passed over the land, gleaning food. This was the primitive nomadic stage of culture and is the mode of life now followed by the African bushman.
Besides the basics of this anthropology here, collectors, hunters, herders, farmers, etc. Remember what I said a little bit ago. See, this is the trick of the world we live on. We have people in all these stages today, still. How complicated a management process is this? Okay.
So if I'm so hungry, I want to join one of these lines. By calling it a think tank.
Yeah. And certainly, if you didn't know the fact of it, that should be kind of an interesting thing to visualize. This 10-mile-long line just sweeping like a dragnet across the, you know, the surface of the earth. You know, pulling every root, picking up every bug, every, you know, every lizard in their path. Sticking in a pouch to eat later, right?
Two, the hunting stage. The invention of weapon tools enabled man to become a hunter and thus to gain considerable freedom from food slavery. A thoughtful Andonite who had severely bruised his fist in a serious combat rediscovered the idea of using a long stick for his arm and a piece of hard flint bound on the end with sinews for his fist. Many tribes made independent discoveries of this sort, and these various forms of hammers represented one of the great forward steps in human civilization. Today, some Australian natives have progressed little beyond this stage.
So again, you've got the natives in Australia, the Aboriginal peoples there, you know, in that mode. And you can't help but, oh, wow, so that's why the whole Thor hammer thing is such an exalted, see how it has those deep roots, right? They're just pointing that out, you know, that that was a huge element. So of course it's going to get immortalized in something like the legend of Thor and his hammer.
It also points out that the tribulation helped the advancement.
Yep, yep. And again, that's for it always, you know, until you have something that arrests you, you know, you remember they don't think unless they were hungry, right? Something has to pull back on the reins for you if you don't pull back yourself and get you to reflectively think for a second. It's like, oh, wait a minute. You know, and speaking about Thor, here you got the blue man in this other paragraph.
The blue men became expert hunters and trappers. By fencing the rivers, they caught fish in great numbers, drawing the surplus for winter use. Many forms of ingenious snares and traps were employed in catching game, but the more primitive races did not hunt the larger animals.
That's more difficult to do. And if people don't know, you know, look up the relationship between Thor and the blue men in the book. I'll leave that for an assignment. Notice the similarity. You know, you had this, I use even the expression dragnet going across the lands, you know, doing the same thing, you know, and just catching every single thing that's, you know, that's in the river. And we think, oh, only evil modern man does things like that. No, that's... That's as old as, you know, as eating, right?
Three, the pastoral stage. This phase of civilization was made possible by the domestication of animals. The Arabs and the natives of Africa are among the more recent pastoral peoples.
Yeah, so there you go. In terms of pastoral, same thing. We've got this very complicated hodgepodge of mores systems. Keep going.
Pastoral living afforded further relief from food slavery. Man learned to live on the interest of his capital, the increase in his flocks, and this provided more leisure for culture and progress.
You wonder why why do they have these little tiny paragraphs? You know, there's a great one for you to pause and go, oh, wait a minute, I recognize what's going on there. We have the nutrition epic and the security age, and we're finally getting to the point where we can have some of the material comfort era. We're moving through the developmental epics. So, you know, getting to the pastoral stage so that you can begin to get a little bit more leisure. See, and they purposely said for culture, right, and progress, and instead of the mere society, and allows for that advancement or that development. The other thing, of course, that should strike you there is capital. Right? How important capital is to progress. So if you go all anti-capital in the name of progress, you can kiss progress goodbye. I mean, yeah, and again, you know, how simple-minded. You don't want to make capital a complete lifestyle solution. Right? Don't make a ruthless ism out of it. Right? But again, baby bathwater. Right. Throw out the ism, keep the capital. Right? There's just so little, you know, sophisticated thought like that anymore. Your ideas of God are ignorant and superstitious. Therefore, God doesn't exist. You know, because it's obviously just a stupid notion. I mean, we think so simplistically like this anymore. We take the most debased example and expand it to generalize it to everything, and declare the whole domain to be void of value. It's such, you know, childish thinking.
You put it right up there in a spot in the upper domain, unconsciously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and thinking about how unconsciously so much of this stuff happens, you know. You know, we unwittingly get into this mode. And it's not just that many religions are unwitting secularists. You know, we're all unwittingly all kinds of unfortunate things. I mean, no one is reflectively thinking anymore. So that just means by definition, you're just a giant pile of unwitting ignorance. Everything about you is unfortunate when you're in that non-reflective mode and non-discriminating mode. You need to be discriminating about what you let in. You can't just open the doors and just let whatever the heck, you know, the environment, you know, feeds you in.
You know. I need a wall for that.
Yes, you might want to build some walls, around, especially around that inner sanctum, right? Exactly. There's a place for these things. Yes, exactly, as you recognize there. Okay, keep going.
Pre-pastoral society was one of sex cooperation, but the spread of animal husbandry reduced women to the depths of social slavery. In earlier times, it was man's duty to secure the animal food, woman's business to provide the vegetable edibles. Therefore, when man entered the pastoral era of his existence, woman's dignity fell greatly. She must still toil to produce the vegetable necessities of life, whereas the man need only go to his herds to provide an abundance of animal food. Man thus became relatively independent of woman. Throughout the entire pastoral age, woman's status steadily declined. By the close of this era, she had become scarcely more than a human animal, consigned to work and to bear human offspring, much as the animals of the herd were expected to labor and bring forth young. The men of the pastoral ages had great love for their cattle, all the more pity they could not have developed a deeper affection for their wives.
Okay, so they throw in that poignant example. Like I said, I mean, you know, by and large, you know, marriage and family are dealt with up in the, you know, three papers later on. But, you know, as we saw before, you know, they throw in some of this in context. Again, to try to help you to put things in context, right? When you look to, you know, what did they say there? The Arabs and the natives of Africa are among the more recent pastoral peoples. Oh, that's why women have their place in those societies like they do. Okay, now, can you objectively approach that? It's like, well, we have to just radically, change. No. That's an inherent part of that stage of evolution. Oh, I mean, how difficult is that? Yeah. See, that's why normally in a world, you don't have people in a more advanced stage. You know, everyone's going through the pastoral stage, and everyone just takes it for granted, and it's just fine, right? And eventually it moves on, and there's, you know, there's an improved relationship between men and women again. But it's just, that's the part of the process. You know, and it has to build to enough of a contrast where finally, you know, these very dense individuals go, wait a minute, I'm pretty sure I'm treating my cattle better than my wife. It never even occurred to me. Yeah, but finally the difference got so stark that even our dense skulls, you know, were penetrated.
So if you're one good wife, rush and make everything perfectly so-called equal and everything, then you are thwarting unity in the name of unity, as you said earlier, and what we're doing
it all the time.
You can look at this, and you know this is going to happen on all the planets.
Again, it's very difficult. You know, see, I mean,
thinking that we're doing a good thing.
Yeah, the big difference on our planet. You know, the facts are the same on every planet. But the difference on our planet is we have all of this recognition of ideals. In the face of these early stages of evolution, that's not normally there.
Plus, they normally have a Dalmatian.
Yeah, sure. But that's the challenge. Sure, yeah, there is a difference, yeah. But the challenge, remember we brought up, the prince's staff has a lot more recognition of ideals than we do. Think about how much tension they have. As for millennia, they watch everyone on the planet in this very unfortunate state of the degradation of women, you know, in society. If they go in there and try to change that by fiat, that's rebellion. Right? They have to just foster it to continue to move forward. It's not merely imperfect. It's perfecting. Yeah, relative to perfection, it's imperfect. But the truth is, it's perfecting, and they foster that perfectingness, the goodness of it, despite how limited it is as a fact in time. And that's the challenge. See, we, like I said, that's how important it is to think about the prince's staff. We have to, all those who are in the kind of the leading edge of civilization on this planet, have to be a lot like the prince's staff and be patiently humble about where people are. You have to be very cautious about presuming upon the evolutionary process. But you also don't just totally stay hands off. You know, because of course, you know, there's so much transportation and communication. Now we can't stay separate. We're forced together. So we have to somehow learn to how to manage this. It's going to be very difficult. Yeah.
And you could even today change this to say the men of the Middle East have great love for their cars. All the more pity they
couldn't. Yeah.
I mean, so it's not really changed a whole lot in some areas. No. In different.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, we don't have to belabor. This is pretty straightforward. But just, you know, see, this is these rugged truths. I mean, do we have enough self-control to live on this world? Or are you just going to just explode inside, you know, at the primitiveness of things and, you know, just, you know, violently react to it? So it's
we do need the world, though.
Very difficult. Okay. Yeah, so we've got these issues. And just one little thing. Remember how they were, you know, hinting at moving love up the levels of meaning, you know, and they said sex, love, you know, of course, it's literally just sex, hunger, not love at all. You know, here they're doing it again, right? If you go up from the first level of meaning, the level of the flesh, to the level of the feelings, okay, you call a feeling their love, like they just did, had great love for their cattle. Okay, we're not talking about sixth level of meaning here, okay? But what is it? What's technically that so-called love is what? The
affection.
Affection, right? They told you right there, right? Affection is the precise word for what's on the second level of meaning. It's not love, it's affection. Just like what's on the fourth level of meaning is not technically brotherly love. It's kindness. But it is what love looks like when you haven't gotten all the way up to the sixth level of meaning yet. Just like love looks like affection when you're on the second. Or like sex hunger when you're on the first. Okay, so just note when they do that, they're trying to give you the precise terms. So if you want to be precise, that's the feeling. Affection is the feeling. Love is not a feeling. Okay, what about the next one?
Four, the agricultural stage. This era was brought about by the domestication of plants, and it represents the highest type of material civilization. Both Caligastia and Adam endeavored to teach horticulture and agriculture. Adam and Eve were gardeners, not shepherds, and gardening was an advanced culture in those days. The growing of plants exerts an ennobling influence on all races of mankind.
We'll get to the specifics of that, you know, why it's an ennobling influence. You know, they'll point it out here in a minute. Yeah, but just, you know, notice, you know, what those, the first and second epical revelation agents were up to. They were just trying to foster moving forward through these stages. I mean, there was agriculture there before, you know, maybe it's just the women doing it, but they're trying to make it, to generalize it. So they're taking what's already there and just fostering it forward. They didn't bring agriculture in out of the blue to the people. Okay? You know, and so that's the important thing. You know, when you think about engaging some other culture, right? I mean, you're trying to encourage what they already have forward. Don't bring in some total non sequitur. You don't have the right to do that. Yeah. You're not respecting the evolutionary process when you do that.
Agriculture more than quadrupled the land-man ratio of the world. It may be combined with the pastoral pursuits of the former cultural stage. When the three stages overlap, men hunt and women till the soil.
So why, when you have all these, still have that going on? See, they're pointing out it's not just some sort of a arbitrary imposition. There must be something natural, right? The directionality of hunting, the place like, right, of tilling the soil. It's obvious. It's the place direction differential between women and men. Land-man ratio. I mean, a lot of land for one man. You know, you go to agriculture, you don't just have your little pen for your flock or something. You know, you got this great big field, right, tied to one man.
Could they give us a little bit of an idea of the land-man ratio when they say 1 acre, every family should have an acre?
Again, I mean, this will come up more in the future. They're just kind of teasing it forward here. There's a whole bunch more about land-man ratio stuff, yeah.
There has always been friction between the herders and the tillers of the soil. The hunter and herder were militant, warlike. The agriculturalist is a more peace-loving type. Association with animals suggests struggle and force. Association with plants instills patience, quiet, and peace. Agriculture and industrialism are the activities of peace. But the weakness of both, as world social activities, is that they lack excitement and adventure.
So you're going to have to do something to satiate the excitement and adventure stuff.
You fire up your PC and you got this game that just... and then you go out and plant some cards.
You know, there you see, though, you know, that whole bit about the ennobling influence. I see it instills patience, quiet, peace. Again, remember that they're trying to remind you what they're doing, about how what you're, you know, sort of inescapably up to leads to what kind of a mori system you have. And is it a more peace-like mori system or a more warlike mori system? A lot of it has to do with just what you spend a lot of time with. Aggressive animals or very just calm plants. Right? Right. Anyway, you should, yeah, I hope you see what they're getting at there. They're trying to get you to just reflect on how this naturally works. That an awful lot of it is not thought out. It just naturally, you know, manifests. All right, what else do we have here?
Human society.
Wait, before you go on, I almost forgot the biggie. The friction, what's the classic story of the friction between the herders and the tillers of the soil? Cain and Abel, yeah, of course.
Human society has evolved from the hunting stage through that of the herders to the territorial stage of agriculture. And each stage of this progressive civilization was accompanied by less and less of nomadism. More and more man began to live at home.
Yeah, go read the other one too.
Okay. And now is industry supplementing agriculture, with consequently increased urbanization and multiplication of non-agricultural groups of citizenship classes. But an industrial era cannot hope to survive if its leaders fail to recognize that even the highest social developments must ever rest upon a sound agricultural basis.
So you have the basic science of all that that you could think about there, but just remember what I said up front. There must be this coordination between man and land. You can't divorce yourself totally, thinking you can somehow abstract yourself from the land and still sort of be sound. You can't. You're a human. You're up from the humus. It's innate. Plus, it's the destiny of the finite evolutionary process, the power personality synthesis. Right? If you divorce yourself from power, there's nothing for personality to synthesize with. Right? I mean, you're short-circuiting your relationship to the overall evolutionary process. So that's, you know, what they're getting at between the lines there. All right. Well, they'll be talking a lot more about some of these issues, but they just wanted to sort of lay out the basic framework there. And so we'll get into the final section here of this paper next time and move right on from there. As I've said several times, they're just teasing a number of things here. We'll get into them in greater detail as we go forward. But hopefully that's whetted your appetite a bit. All right, let's take a moment, everyone.